Attention, please. This is Dick Chapman, one of your official civil defense broadcasters with a special message. Military authorities have advised us that an enemy attack by air is imminent. This is a red alert. You are advised to go to your nearest shelter area immediately. Find shelter. There is not time to leave the city. Your state civil defense director has just issued the following instructions. Please remain calm. Every precaution will be taken for your protection. Keep your radio tuned to
Berkeley Liberation Radio
throughout the alert period for information. Telephone service to your home may be cut off to permit military and civil defense authorities to carry out vital operations. Do not attempt to join your family or your children if they are now separated. They will be cared for where they are. Obey your civil defense warden and find shelter now. Take shelter in your basement or in your nearest shelter area. If you can plug in your radio in the basement, take it with you. Use a portable radio set if you have one. Otherwise, turn up the volume of your radio so that you can hear it in the basement. Keep calm. Don't lose your head. If you are at work, obey your civil defense authorities. Go quickly and calmly to your designated shelter. If your children are at school, they are being directed to shelter by their teachers. If you are in an automobile, pull over to the curb and then go immediately to the nearest shelter area. Do not leave your car where it will block traffic. This station will continue to stay on the air throughout the alert period to bring you authentic information and official instructions. Stay tuned to
104.1 FM
on your radio for official information. Refuse to listen to unauthorized rumors or broadcasts. This is your official civil defense broadcast.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
You must be a radio station. And who are we? We must be a number one song spinning all day long. And over again, and over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. And we don't wear what we call it. And nothing's free sounds to me like
this broadcast to bring you the special message about the forecast. The future's cloudy and it's raining on the poor class. Road to peace is closed, heavy traffic on the war paths. Love is balling on the budget. The military says it's gonna need more cash to keep fighting for your gas. Keep us in our hoods and hope we never explore past. Stay inside of your half. Believe the lies you learned in your class. That there's no treasure in your trash. And a Sealy has the same feeling that the floor has. And that's where you should stay. This is what they play.
Over again, and over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. And we don't win, when we come in. And nothing's free sounds to me like
now tuned into the weakest frequency of fear. Keep you locked right here and hope you never leave this. Never be a leader. Think inside the box and follow our procedures. Never ever believe that you will never need this. Hit up all your friends and tell them to repeat this. How you're on the air, now what you wanna hear? Well, we ain't got the truth, but how about a remix? Different is never good. Good is only what we pick. You ain't got a hit unless it sounds like these did. Not too smart, you will be a superstar. And if you dumb as some, maybe you could be number one.
Over again, and over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. And we don't win, when we come in. And nothing's free sounds to me like
stay fun,
radio,
stay fun.
Independent spirits you can barely hear with this. insane. Truth ain't getting on like shampoo on an airplane. Propaganda's everywhere, constantly on replay. All the hits all the time, back to back on relay. We're really where it lives, make them hear the records we play. Build your own station, become your own DJs.
A radio station, who are we? We must be a number one song spinning all day long. And you put me in daily rotation. You're on the air, we know you're scared, but we don't care, we'll play this here.
Over again, and over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. But we don't win, we'll be coming, and nothing's really sounds to me like
stay down.
Just as the school year gets underway across the United States, the top student loan watchdog has resigned in protest against the Trump administration, siding with powerful predatory lenders over student loan borrowers. Seth Frotman works as student loan ombudsman under the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director Mick Mulvaney. In his resignation letter to Mulvaney, he wrote, quote, "Unfortunately, under your leadership, the Bureau has abandoned the very consumers it is tasked by Congress with protecting. Instead, you have used the Bureau to serve the wishes of the most powerful financial companies in America," unquote. Frotman's resignation comes as outstanding student loan debt has topped $1.4 trillion. In the letter, he accused the Bureau of failing to enforce laws that protect borrowers, defending predatory for-profit schools from scrutiny, and suppressing reports that expose banks and other bad actors, quote, ripping off students. Frotman continued, quote, "The Bureau's current leadership folded to political pressure and fail borrowers who depend on independent oversight to halt bad practices. The current leadership of the Bureau has made its priorities clear. It will protect the misguided goals of the Trump administration to the detriment of student loan borrowers."
This comes as Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has proposed new rules that would cut an estimated $13 billion in federal student loan relief for people defrauded by for-profit colleges. The changes would roll back the so-called borrower defense rule President Obama proposed after the collapse of ITT Tech and Corinthian College, which was then halted by the Trump administration. In response, Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey tweeted, "Betsy DeVos rewrote the borrower defense rule to let predatory schools cheat their students and enrich their executives. No surprise." Well, for more, we go to Philadelphia to speak with Dr. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, author of the book Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and Betrayal of the American Dream. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't we begin with the resignation of the top student loan watchdog and what he has accused the Trump administration of?
You know, this is a bold and, I presume, necessary move for someone like Seth Frotman to undertake. He's trying to draw attention to some very serious changes, some of which are not being made public or transparent to taxpayers, that are going to affect not only our ability to afford college, to send our children to college, and to repay our own loans, but also, frankly, for our ability to just have a manageable amount of debt in the United States. These changes are going to cost us all money, and he wants to make sure that we know it.
Well, could you talk in general about the crisis facing so many millions of college students in America today in terms of student loans and student loan debt, and what has been happening under the Trump administration to deal or not deal with the problem?
Well, the crisis is created by what I call the new economics of college. This is a time where, frankly, like it or not, college is essentially mandatory for access to the middle class, for getting one's family out of poverty, and from keeping one's family from falling into poverty. But unfortunately, we have not created a financing system to actually make college attendance possible without having to take on loans. So millions of Americans are taking on loans, even when they don't want to, just to be able to get access to college. Now, when they take those loans, they need to be sure that the risk to themselves is not too high. And frankly, collectively, as taxpayers, we need to be sure that those loans are not too risky to us, that they can be repaid. Now, under the Obama administration, they worked very hard to try to put some protections in place, both for taxpayers and for the borrowers themselves. For example, they wanted to make sure that if students took their loans to a certain type of college called a for-profit college, that they wouldn't be ripped off, that they would get a job afterwards, you know, that their credential would mean something, and they would have a chance to repay their debt. What's happening now is that those protections are being removed. We're told that they're not necessary, but it was clear that they were, because we're receiving tons and tons of fraud complaints about these colleges. And that's the important work that the CFPB has been doing, is to review those fraud claims. Well, the CFPB is now being told it really can't do that work. And what Seth Frotman is telling us is that it hasn't been able to do it for some time.
I want to go back to Seth Frotman's resignation letter. He writes, "The Bureau's new political leadership has repeatedly undercut and undermined career CFPB staff working to secure relief for consumers. These actions will affect millions of student loan borrowers, including those harmed by the company that dominates this market. By undermining the Bureau's own authority to oversee the student loan market, the Bureau has failed borrowers who depend on independent oversight to halt bad practices and bring accountability to the student loan industry." Unquote. The company Frotman is referencing is thought by many observers to be Navient, the nation's largest servicer of student loans, according to lawsuits filed last year by a federal regulator and two states' attorneys general. Navient has for years misled borrowers and made serious mistakes at nearly every step of the collections process, illegally driving up loans repayment costs for millions of borrowers. Can you talk more about this company and what is this relationship with Mick Mulvaney, who called his own bureau, the one that Frotman is resigning from, a joke?
Well, I think that the biggest thing that Seth is pointing out is that we don't fully understand what Mulvaney's relationships are. I think that we have some speculation as to what's going on here, but he keeps alluding to the fact that, you know, the real issues going on inside that agency are not being made transparent. And we, I think, have the same concerns, frankly, about the U.S. Department of Education and Secretary DeVos's own relationships, both with these companies and with for-profit companies. That transparency is really key in order to be able to protect consumers. You know, these places like Navient are servicing loans, which, you know, a lot of people are really struggling to pay off. And many folks who are not able to repay their debt, it's not necessarily that they didn't have the money, but they weren't given the right information. The repayment process and the collections process was not transparent to them. It was not easy to follow. And so we have people who are falling into economic hardship, and defaulting on a loan is a very serious mark for somebody's economic record because these companies are not doing the right thing. You know, I think what Seth is raising questions about is the advice and the practices of career people in Washington. And for those who don't know those folks, I mean, these are some very hardworking people who stay regardless of who's in charge of the White House and really stick by the job of these agencies and departments. And the contrast between that and what the political appointees are doing, who don't seem to really be aligned with the mission of the agency.
And what about the issue of what Congress is doing? We're talking about more than $1.4 trillion in student debt, an exploding problem in the country. And yet Congress, years back, ruled that in personal bankruptcy cases, you can't discharge your student debt. So it basically follows you through life no matter what.
That's right. And, you know, there are some reasons, some of which are irrational, some of which are rational for those kinds of rules. I mean, but the big challenge is this. You know, Congress has not taken on in a serious way the need to create a financing system in this country that makes it possible for people to go to college without having to take on loans. That's the hard work that needs to be done, and it really hasn't happened. And for the folks who have taken on loans, they've made it incredibly hard for them to repay that debt, get out of that debt, for example, if they serve in terms of public service, if they become teachers in low-income schools. There's talk of rolling back that loan forgiveness. So, you know, it seems that Congress is at odds with the will of the American people.
Your work has been credited with really helping to lay the groundwork for Bernie Sanders' proposal for free college education. Please explain.
Well, the studies that my team and I have undertaken over the last 20 years have revealed that the current financial aid system just isn't getting the job done. In many ways, it's well-intentioned. It suggests that we can help people without money by giving them grants that they have to fill out the FAFSA to receive, this application that takes ages to fill out, and that we will somehow make up for their lack of money by giving them that financial aid. We find that doesn't actually work in practice for many reasons, including that families can't get through the application. They may not have parents to fill out the application for some students who are estranged, for example, from their parents. And then there's a whole middle class in this country that find themselves, you know, too rich to qualify for grants, but too poor to be able to afford these college prices. That's where a free college model comes in. And it isn't about assuming that everything in life is free or that if you don't have to pay something, you don't work hard. But just as we value people in this country being able to go to high school, and we wouldn't want to have a country where people turned away from high school because the tuition is too high, we believe it's now time to start thinking at least about the 13th and 14th years of education as something that we need to collectively pay for so that anybody, especially anybody hardworking and talented in this country, which is the majority of people, can get the college education that they need.
What about the for-profit industry? Because clearly you have the private nonprofit colleges, the state universities and state colleges, but there's been an explosion of the for-profit industry, and we've seen some major failures of some of these, but some continue to prosper, basically on the backs of this loan program.
That's right. I mean, in many ways, the model that we're operating under is a voucher-driven model. And it allows private providers to compete for student aid dollars alongside public providers, but unfortunately with a lot less scrutiny and no public governance. And so the result is that companies have realized they can step in, they can get students to walk in their doors by recruiting them with commercials. They spend a lot of money on advertising. They bring the students in, and in many cases, not all, but in most cases, the students do not experience the sort of education that will lead them to lead a better life, get a better job, or earn more money. And it is an industry, and frankly, this is also a deeply racialized practice, because these schools disproportionately reach out to, recruit, prey on people of color. And those are people who really do not have the same access to forms of payment other than student loans that other folks have. So they go into deep debt and they get useless credentials.
Finally, very quickly, Professor Goldrick Rabb, your report, Hungry and Homeless in College. You say of the students you surveyed, 1 in 3 reported they'd gone hungry while enrolled in college?
That's correct. Now, this has been a decade worth of research now, and we have found that actually it's 1 in 3 students at 4-year colleges and universities, and between 40 to 50% of students at the nation's community colleges. This is how severe the loan crisis really is. You can take loans and have trouble repaying them, and nonetheless still not have enough money to cover today's college prices. And those prices are not just tuition, it's housing and food. So students are legitimately falling short of what they need to learn and to get degrees.
This is how it started. It's not hard to understand. From coast to coast, they're lying at a CEO's command. From nationalist public radio, CNN and NBC. Big Brother spewing propaganda from the disinformation ministry. They say the economy is booming. We hear the homeless beggars' cries. They say we help poor countries. We see bombs falling from the skies. Reality doesn't exist, they're trying to say. But some of us decided there is another way. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. Someone got a transmitter, started up a station. Then the idea spread right across the nation. Like the land and water, the air must be free. So let us shout together, fuck the FCC, seize the airwaves, seize the time. Cause lying to the people is the real crime when it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. And we'll do it all together in a grassroots style, tearing down the fences throughout this whole square mile. It's the new town meeting, it's the way the news should be. The rulers call it chaos, we say it's democracy. So when you turn on the radio and you've had it with this shit, from 88 to 107 makes you wanna have a fit. When you listen to the music and it's all the same pop song, start up a pirate station, cause that's where you belong. Seize the airwaves, seize the time, cause lying to the people is the real crime when it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. Seize the airwaves, seize the time, cause lying to the people is the real crime when it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard.
The American Cancer Society says on its website that, quote, radio frequency waves given off by cell phones don't have enough energy to damage DNA directly or to heat body tissues. Because of this, it's not clear how cell phones might be able to cause cancer. Most studies, say the ACS, done in the lab have supported the idea that RF waves do not cause DNA damage. Indeed, the idea that cell phones cause cancer is generally accepted as an assertion of conspiracy theorists. Now, an in-depth investigative report by The Nation magazine has found that since the 1990s, cell phone industry representatives have sought to hide the link between certain forms of brain tumors and cell phone usage. Mark Hertzgard is my guest, and he joins me to discuss his Nation magazine cover story, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe, a special investigation. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about who it was, the cell phone industry representative that later went on to occupy a very special government position, basically worked to tamp down what one of his own researchers found. Tom Wheeler, a familiar name to those people who have studied the issue of net neutrality, in the 1990s was part of the cell phone industry. And the researcher that he hired and his industry representatives hired to give them the result that they wanted turned out to give them the opposite result. Tell us that story in a nutshell.
Sure. Thomas Wheeler is a very good example of the revolving door syndrome that occurs in Washington, D.C., where top industry people end up in top government positions and then go back into industry. So as you mentioned, Tom Wheeler was the chair of the Federal Communications Commission under President Barack Obama. And the FCC, of course, is the regulator of the wireless industry, cell phones included. But in the 1990s, Tom Wheeler was the head of the Wireless Industries Trade Association, the CTIA. So he was essentially the wireless industry's point man in Washington, their key lobbyist. And in 1993, the wireless industry had a problem because cell phones had been released on the U.S. consumer market without government safety testing, which I found is probably the single most extraordinary fact we uncovered in doing this investigation for The Nation magazine. And by 1993, some customers were getting cancer, and they were blaming the phones, and they were suing some of the cell phone manufacturers. So Tom Wheeler quickly called a press conference and told the media, we're going to have our own big research program into this. Of course, cell phones are safe. We're just going to revalidate that. So he hired a gentleman called George Carlo, an epidemiologist, who seemed like a good bet at the time because Carlo had done research for the chemical industry that said that dioxin in small doses wasn't so terrible. And he had done research for the breast implants saying that those weren't necessarily so bad.
So he was a reliable scientist who could be relied upon to toe the industry line.
I think that's what Tom Wheeler thought, and even George Carlo admits that he did do those studies. He said that he was an honest man, but he says, look, I'm sure they saw me as an industry guy. But by the end of the 1990s, after George Carlo had supervised a $28.5 million study, which both commissioned about 50 new scientific studies, but also reviewed all the existing literature, not just here in the United States, but the scientific literature around the world. He came back, George Carlo came back to the industry with the answer they did not want to hear. And he said that there were quote unquote serious questions about cell phones and cancer and genetic damage, especially among children. And he then put those concerns in writing in a smoking gun memo from October 7, 1999. Which he wrote to the CEO of AT&T and the CEO of about 28 of the other biggest companies in the wireless industry, laying out the findings and saying, look, these are preliminary. This doesn't prove the issue one way or the other, but it looks like there's the possibility of cancer and DNA damage, and you must do the right thing. You should tell consumers as much information as we have so that they can decide how much of this risk they want to take on for themselves. And by the way, some members of the industry are falsely saying that phones are safe, including for children, and that's simply not true. Well, once the scientists sent that letter, Tom Wheeler, the head of the industry trade association, went berserk and starts trashing him in the media and basically saying, you never showed us these studies, they were never peer-reviewed, you know, a bunch of lies, frankly. But it worked. And Tom Wheeler doused the controversy. Most of the journalists on the beat bought the story, and the cell phone industry went on to basically become now today the fastest growing industry on earth, certainly one of the biggest, and you'd have to say one of the most influential industries around the world. You and I are talking on wireless technology.
Right.
This is the big technology of our time, and it turns out that just like Big Tobacco lied about cigarettes, and just like Big Oil lied about climate change, Big Wireless has misled us about the true state of science regarding cell phone radiation.
Let's try to dig through a little bit of the reasoning behind why cell phones might not be safe, because people get cancer all the time, and, you know, different kinds of cancers, different parts of your body. Some people are genetically predisposed to it. Others get it because they live next to certain kind of industries. To really definitively connect cancer incidence to any particular cause requires very detailed studies, right? It's very hard to truly point a strong connection. It was years of research to connect lung cancer with cigarette smoking. So how do you sort of explain what the theory might be as to how cell phones could cause cancer, what kinds of cancer, and has that even been studied properly?
Sure. And let me emphasize here, Sonali, that our piece does not argue, our investigative expose in The Nation magazine does not argue that cell phones are dangerous or that they're safe. That is for scientists to decide. But what we do in our piece is expose for the first time this long propaganda campaign that the wireless industry has mounted for decades now to convince us that cell phones are safe. The truth of the matter is that if you look at the voluminous amount of independent science that's been done now on this, there is a lot of evidence that indicates not just cancer, but also genetic damage. And we'll get into that in a second. Mm-hmm. But I want to emphasize here that one of the findings in our expose is the stark difference between industry-funded science and independently funded science. It looks, if you just look at all of the science together, that there is a split. Some scientists think there is cancer to this radiation, some don't. But scientists who were skeptical about this, a man named Henry Lai, who is a professor of bioengineering emeritus out of the University of Washington, who studied in this area a long time, he looked at those same studies, but he divided them by funding source. And when you do that, the industry-funded studies are 2.5 times less likely to find any kind of health effect than the independently funded studies. That is a devastating fact. Mm-hmm. And so it basically just shows, again, like with Big Oil and with Big Tobacco, what industry did is they sought to create the appearance of scientific uncertainty. And how do they do that? Well, we show they fund their own science. They put industry-friendly scientists on the advisory bodies like the World Health Organization and others. They discredit scientists who question these findings and so forth. You can read the article for all the details. And they do this not just in the United States, but in Europe and Asia as well. So that's really the context in which we have to look at the science. And I want to also reassure everyone who may be listening or watching, just because there is this clear evidence of cancer doesn't mean that every one of you using a wireless device is going to get cancer. And there are specific things that you can do to lower your risk of cancer. And we can talk about that. But understand that most of what you have been told about this cancer risk over the past 25 years has been misleading because it came from the wireless industry. And I'm sorry to say our own profession of journalism has been overly credulous, just like we were with climate change and with tobacco. We have a shameful history here. Let's not get hoodwinked. Let's stop being hoodwinked on this and realize that the wireless industry has been playing us for 25 years.
You've studied the climate crisis. There is a playbook, right? That, you know, obviously moneyed interests in various industries share this playbook, the big tobacco playbook, the climate denialism playbook, and now we're find out on cell phones as well. And a big part of the playbook isn't necessarily saying definitively that these things are safe, but simply to cause enough doubt that you question them, and then people sort of, you know, decide who they want to believe. But once you have enough doubt and create enough skepticism, you've essentially, that the industry is essentially won, right?
They're able to blunt any calls for reform. And yes, I came to this investigation of Big Wireless after, you know, I've covered the climate issue for many years now. And I did, I think, the first big expose back in 2006 in Vanity Fair magazine that was the first to draw the connection between the climate deniers and big tobacco. And it was a man named Frederick Seitz, S-E-I-T-Z. And he was the, we called him the $45 million man, because he took $45 million of tobacco money to basically investigate every possible cause of lung cancer except for cigarettes. And then years later, he became the most important scientist who was a climate denier. So that's how I found my way back to the whole tobacco story. And yes, this is the same playbook. Big Tobacco pioneered this playbook. Big Oil perfected this playbook. And now Big Wireless is borrowing this very same playbook and bringing it up to date.
So essentially, we have these devices that emit and accept radio frequency wireless signals in order to communicate either with satellites, so that's cell service, or with the Wi-Fi router in your home or office or workplace. And that constant invisible wireless communication, it has the potential, in theory, to, say, disrupt DNA in your bodies if it can sort of penetrate the barriers in your bloodstream and in your organs, etc. If you hold a phone up right to your ear, you are putting that radiation close to your brain, a very important organ. And so the theory goes that you could cause damage, you could trigger tumors. Is that sort of accurate? And if so, what are some safeguards, or are there safeguards one can put into place that can protect oneself and still be a cell phone user?
Yes, it's important to emphasize, as we do in our story, that scientists do not fully understand the mechanisms here. Just as, and you mentioned this, Sonali, just as we didn't understand, tobacco researchers did not understand at first how smoking cigarettes caused various illnesses. So it's not entirely known. It is known, however, that this radiation has breached the brain-blood barrier. You know, we talk about it in the article, that it's generally thought that the cancer effect is indirect. But, you know, this is a moving story. And just last week, just Wednesday night, a very important study occurred. And again, the U.S. media has totally ignored it. But there was peer review of a major U.S. government study by the National Toxicology Program, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. They peer-reviewed one of the biggest studies yet on cell phone radiation, and they concluded that there was, quote-unquote, clear evidence that this kind of radiation can cause cancer. So if you want to reduce your risk of that, one thing is to use a landline. Get an old landline back. Use that as much as possible. I have a landline. I also have a cell phone. I use the cell phone when necessary, but always You must use it with earbuds. Always limit your calls. Don't stay on the phone for 45 minutes. You know, say what you need to and get off, because it's all a question of the exposure. The more you're exposed to it, the more likely it is that cancer will happen. And again, you mentioned this in your intro, you know, some people are more or less susceptible to this. Remember, not everybody who smokes cigarettes gets lung cancer. It's a combination of factors that influence whether any human organism gets cancer.
But surely, given the explosion of cell phone ownership and usage around the world, we would have seen some corresponding increase in certain kinds of brain tumors, right?
Yes, and there are researchers who would say that, yes, you are seeing that.
Huh.
It is still hard to detect that out of the statistical noise, partly because these cancers take a long time to develop.
Ah.
And remember, although cell phones have been on the market in the United States since 1984, they really weren't ubiquitous until the mid to late 90s, and people have been using them far, far more now than they used to. You know, it used to be maybe a phone call, a quick snatch of conversation. Now, I mean, you walk down any city street, people are glued to their phones.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Now let me tell you a story about a long time ago in a country called the USA. A land once ruled by a cool black dude, but now he was going away. The country was changing, healthcare was failing, and jobs were going overseas. Then a man with a tan came along with a plan, said only I can cure this disease. The forgotten man, Donald Trump is your friend. The forgotten man, you'll never be forgotten again.
The forgotten man.
Jordan Klepper, everybody.
Thank you.
Now everyone laughed at the businessman. They called him a media clown. Said the president's coming from the Clinton clan and Paul Ryan's gonna take you down. But everyone forgot the forgotten man, cause forgetting them is nothing new. And now that they've got their man in charge, let's see what he's gonna do.
Since President Trump took office, federal agencies and the Republican-controlled House has delayed, suspended, or reversed more than 90 regulations.
Many of the changes came after appeals by corporate lobbyists and trade association executives.
Okay, I would have started with the people myself, but I guess lobbyists are forgotten too. And maybe they'll create a bunch of new jobs getting rid of all those pesky rules. Now, probably not. It's never worked before. But that's not what this song is about. I bet the deregulation will open the door to help the forgotten man out.
President Trump says loosening environmental regulations will be a boon to the coal industry. Trump has made it easier for coal mining companies to dump waste into waterways. Now, this nixes an Obama regulation put in place at the end of his term to protect rivers and streams.
Now, before you get mad about the extra pollution, let me tell you about what this means. More pollution means more coal means more jobs, so who cares if they poison the streams? Because the forgotten man needs jobs, not water, although also water. I mean, everyone needs water. Humans are like 70% water. We're basically water balloons with bones inside of us.
Hot damn!
That's right. But Trump's not the president of water. He came to help the forgotten man, so what if he has nothing to drink? The forgotten man, Trump's doing more than you think.
The forgotten man.
President Trump is beginning to loosen the regulations on financial institutions. After meeting with several heads of Wall Street's biggest banks, the president signed a new executive order easing regulations. The order removes the so-called fiduciary rule and will no longer require financial professionals to act strictly in the customer's best interest when giving advice about retirement accounts.
Wait, so we're trusting these crooks from the housing crisis to not screw us over this time? Now it's legal for them to give folks bad advice just to make an extra dime? Not a literal dime. It's billions of dollars. I was focusing more on the rhyme. This is music. But I'm starting to think that Trump's pulling a con and he don't have the forgotten in mind.
The Federal Communications Commission gave internet providers the go-ahead to sell your personal information without your permission.
The forgotten man. Well, hold on. Wait, what? Trump administration is letting cable companies sell our browsing history? That is some that needs to stay forgotten, people. Why would Trump do this?
I don't know.
Not now, Jordan.
If you say you're all about the forgotten man, then why would your priorities be the corporations? Now, Wall Street can screw over the people, the coal buses can pollute the water, and our browsing histories are for sale? Oh, browsing histories. I need to go delete something. I'll be back, guys. I gotta go.
We'll be right back.
And welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's show, we'll discuss the importance of alternative and independent media in the face of growing concerns that big tech platforms are increasingly censoring these very important voices. We're joined right now by Dr. Andrew Austin. One of the big issues that's been happening the past couple of weeks is Alex Jones of InfoWars, nearly simultaneously sacked from many of these platforms. And we just wanted to have you launch in at that point in terms of the issue of free press. And do you consider this a kind of censorship?
The background on this is that you're right. It was almost a simultaneous purging. You had Facebook, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, all coming out in a matter of several hours, removing Alex Jones and, in some cases, his program InfoWars from those social media sites. Specifically, Facebook, just to give you a quote for the reason why they did this, they said that Jones was, quote, glorifying violence, which violates our graphic violence policy, and using dehumanizing language to describe people who are transgender, Muslim, and immigrants, which violates our hate speech policy. And then, of course, the media, in giving examples to that, is very quick to bring up his famous role in 9/11, you know, arguing that there were false flag operations in the attacks that we suffered on 9/11. And probably most notorious of all is his argument that Sandy Hook incidents was a hoax replete with crisis actors. What strikes me about particularly the issue of censorship is the way in which this growth in what the Supreme Court has described as a modern public square is operating beyond the bounds of really the First Amendment. And so the question is, what role does free speech have in an increasingly privatized world in which you have monopolies, which are effectively utilities, deciding the content that then audiences can access? Because I think one of the most important things about free speech, people understand, is it's not just the speaker, it's the ability of people to be able to hear opinion. So this has very deep possibilities, if you will, in a negative sense, I think, for freedom going forward.
There is an idea out here that because this is the private sector, although it's interesting to unpack that given how many corporate tax subsidies and how much research and development and how much of that bleeds into companies like Google, particularly from the military-industrial complex. So there's mm-hmm. clearly a blurring, I would argue, there. But nevertheless, one of the arguments about this issue is that these are private companies. And so, therefore, if someone is on that platform and they are behaving in a way that does not behoove the shareholders or does not behoove the company's interests in its public image, that it has the right to not have people. And so this gets to be complicated in terms of the way that it contradicts the spirit of the First Amendment. However, it's also perfectly legal until challenged.
The analogy in my mind for all this is public accommodation. And the segregationists argue that equal treatment provision of the 14th Amendment, that the language strongly suggested that only the government cannot discriminate, right? So that a private company can discriminate. So the segregationists would say, well, I can decide, I own the restaurant, I can decide who can be in the restaurant or not, who I can associate with, and so forth. And the Civil Rights Act of 1964 clarified that, right? That the right to not be discriminated against was at the individual level, had to do with individual sovereignty, not with the right of property to exclude people. And that the protection of the First Amendment wasn't just about the government sort of not oppressing people, but the government defending the oppression of people by private entities. And when you think of these monopolies as really being functionally public utilities, I really believe there's a public accommodations issue. And just as we promote racial diversity in public spaces that are operated by private firms, that we also need to recognize ideological and intellectual diversity in these spaces as well. I would think that the First Amendment would cover that. Maybe it will take another act of Congress to clarify that situation. I mean, they're having to clarify the situation with respect to, say, the free speech rights of gay couples to have their sentiments expressed on cakes in private businesses. We'll see how that works out. But I see that as very analogous. I also see it as really running up against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the European Declaration of Human Rights, Articles 19 in the former and 10 in the latter, right, of protecting the right of individuals to be able to transmit information unimpeded and in a private world. That shouldn't make any difference that these firms are private if that's indeed a human right. The idea that private sphere could interfere with the human rights of individuals is difficult for me to accept.
Obviously, Alex Jones is the canary in the coal mine for this issue right now. Have you seen that there are also some other independent voices on the left that are starting to be censored in the same way?
If we're paying attention, we'll see that there's been several canaries here. Before Alex Jones and this rather highly publicized deplatforming, Facebook, going back, contrary to what Zuckerberg said, you might remember when he bragged about how Facebook would not censor Holocaust deniers and revisionists from having the debate. But the fact is that going back to 2005, Facebook has been deplatforming those who question the Holocaust. They deactivated Corinne Gaines' account, which meant that they removed Philando Castile's killing at the hands of police. Was something that at the time we were making note of, but has been quickly forgotten. They removed that iconic photograph, the Napalm Girl, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning photographer Nick Utt. They censored that. They've removed the reports of the suppression of indigenous resistance. They've removed not merely black activist content, but they've removed reports of black activist content, sort of depriving people of the right to complain about Facebook's removal of content. And then we've seen the dismantling, or I should say the disabling, of Palestinian journalist accounts. In fact, after Zuckerberg met with Israeli Prime Minister, there was a string of removals of Palestinian sites. And Telesur, it was just taken down. This is a site that Breitbart describes as communist propaganda. So you can see a real ideological bias in the sites that are being taken down. And yes, what I tell people about the Alex Jones affair is that they've coming after the left, and we're not just arguing a slippery slope here. They have been coming after the left for quite a long time, which is not to suggest that Holocaust denial is something on the left. They're also doing this with some Christian ministries that have particularly vile content about homosexuals and so forth. But the effects on the left, which we have to admit that many people on the left saw Alex Jones being taken down with relish. They enjoyed that. They need to, I think, be a bit concerned about what that legitimizes.
In the case of Alex Jones, where we have someone that's very contentious, right? And again, broken clocks are right twice a day. Alex has actually had some decent analysis factually on certain issues around civil rights and so forth, civil liberties over the years. But of course, that gets drowned out by the several examples that you gave up, particularly Sandy Hook and so on, and crisis actors and so forth. But there is a sense of some celebration among other free speech characters. In fact, KPFA, the station where we originate from, has recently canceled a controversial program, Guns and Butter, by Bonnie Faulkner, that actually carried many of these kinds of arguments and talked about these kinds of things. And so under the auspice of Free Speech Radio, we see, well, hey, they say, well, we can't seem to afford to have that kind of programming and that kind of what they call false news. Or see, we're getting into this fake news issue.
Yeah.
How fake news is a Trojan horse to somehow censor certain viewpoints. What's your idea on that?
I'm troubled by that because, I mean, it's long been the case that the Supreme Court has recognized a certain freedom, if you will, to lie, a freedom to distort, a freedom to engage in parody and satire. And sometimes it's difficult to know what it is that you're looking at. I mean, Alex Jones, I'm a bit perplexed by him at times. You know, he described himself in a court transcript as being a performance artist. And for years, I've kind of thought of him as a performance artist. Like, can a person really believe this stuff? He was on the Joe Rogan show fairly recently, and they were drinking and getting high, and it was really comical. And he's let Rogan and the audience in on a kind of a joke about who Alex Jones is. I think the problem is they have these algorithms that are targeting and selecting and so forth, but what a lot of people don't know is there's around 7,500 human censors at Facebook, and we don't know who they are. They're all over the planet. What is their expertise? Are they particularly keen on being able to distinguish between what's parody and what's this and so forth? And do we really want, even if they could do that, would we really want people deciding what it is we can and can't see? I've always been a bit suspicious of people who watch something and say, well, gosh, that's terrible. We shouldn't let people see that. And it's like, I'm sure you don't have a problem with seeing it, but you want other people not to see it. And the idea that we would let people make decisions for other people about what kind of media they consume, whether it's on the right or whether it's on the left or whether it's parody or whether it's distortion, so forth, it's very troubling to me. Again, it goes back to that argument we used to make in the 1980s. Remember when they were trying to put warning labels on music? We don't want people listening to Judas Priest's song, you know, Eat Me Alive.
The PMRC.
Yeah, so it's a very clever song, I thought. But the thing is, nobody forces you to listen to Judas Priest. Nobody forces people to watch Alex Jones. And so we have this modern public square, as Kennedy described it, but it's an odd kind of public square. It's almost more like the television, where people can slot in and watch that. If they don't like that, they can step out and so forth. So the idea that people making choices to consume media is a great danger, and therefore we have to control what people see, says something about this monopoly's opinion of the ordinary person who's out there trying to get information or is trying to just enjoy something. I mean, one thing you can say about Alex Jones, it is a spectacle to behold on a comedic level. It's quite entertaining. And so I just don't trust, particularly I don't trust Zuckerberg to decide for me the content that I should consume. First of all, the public has a perfect right to organize and protest speech that they don't like. I mean, that's their free speech right, too. So if people want to say, I don't like what Alex Jones is saying. But I also think that these services have an obligation to defend speech against the majoritarian impulse. Free speech is a civil liberty. And we're talking about majoritarianism. We're not even talking about organized democratic intervention, right? We're talking about flack that's being sent by large numbers of people, interest groups that are presumed to be the majority. Twitter, you know, they didn't do this in the case of Roseanne Barr and some others, but they have done this with respect to Alex Jones. They have resisted not only the calls of what appear to be very large numbers of the public, but also other media, which is actually going through and saying, well, you say that he's not violating your terms, but yet you ban this person for this reason and this person for this reason. So we have the corporate media is really putting a lot of pressure on Twitter to try to follow suit. For the public, there's always going to be those who are going to respond to things that are offensive by organizing boycotts and campaigns and petitions and so forth and so on. But I think we have to make the argument that as despicable as speech can be, that the free speech right, and this is cliche, but it's so important to repeat, the free speech right is there precisely to protect despicable speech. I mean, if it was a matter of protecting speech that we agreed with, we wouldn't need a right. That's the easy part. And so the public needs to be educated about what the First Amendment means, but also be educated about the threat to the First Amendment when monopolies become the de facto government and inflate the concept of defamation, for instance, way beyond its foundation in, say, English common law. One of the famous reasons that Christopher Hitchens gave for leaving England is that it was becoming almost impossible to be critical over there because you were losing the right to complain because you would defame somebody and you would wind up in court having to fight for that right. So I think it's a matter of educating the public about the free speech right, connecting it to our fundamental human rights, and arguing for a vigorous defense of speech against the majority, against the government, and in particular in this case we're talking about, against these giant social media platforms, which have an absolutely unbelievable amount of power. I mean, Facebook is global and reaches one-third of the world's population, and they're teaming with the security state. We can talk about the Atlanta Council, sort of the core of the intelligence and security apparatus, the privatized core of that. We have Facebook actually bringing them on board to become part of this human censorship machine. That's very, very troubling because you have, as you were pointing out earlier, at the behest of the U.S. and Israeli government, you have Zuckerberg taking down websites. And so even though they're saying, well, we're private and we should be free from government control, they're in bed with government. And, of course, they obviously depend on government fundamentally because the Internet, the very service that they depend on, was developed by the government, supported by the taxpayers, and functions quite analogously to the electric grids or to telecommunication.
That's exactly right, Andrew. You're right. We don't need the First Amendment to protect our right to say, I love cupcakes and pizza is good. That's not why we have the First Amendment. And you're also right that Twitter has responded differently than other tech platforms in the space in regards to censorship. In fact, one of the features that they introduced a while back was that they would blur out something that is apparently contentious in your newsfeed and then would allow you to click on it whether or not you actually want to see the content.
I don't have much of a problem with that because when you're scrolling through various pages or tweets and so forth, you can see things inadvertently that are very disturbing. And so it's a little bit different from selecting a channel and knowing what you're going to see. I think that's a reasonable compromise. It's nowhere close to just taking down a page because an internal censor believes that that would be offensive to a large number of people. One of the nice things about government, when government does something, is that you have a redress of your grievances, is the famous phrase, right? It took until this spring for Facebook to tell us what their community standards were. turns out they had a 27-page censorship guide that they give to their human censors, who they call content moderators, who then decide that. But there's still no way of appealing when YouTube takes down pages and when Facebook takes down pages. Spotify, in fact, Spotify has a really nasty message saying that anybody who does this will not get their page back. So there's no way to negotiate. At some level, though, I think that's an attempt by these companies to try to stave off government regulation. When Zuckerberg was at his congressional hearings, when I was watching him, it looked very much like a person who was trying to answer questions very carefully to kind of keep the government at bay, that we don't want the government to step in and regulate. Now, a lot of those congressmen have different objections. If they had their way, they would probably censor, too, just different sorts of things. And there's a real burden on these companies to address the concerns of consumers because, you know, if I work for a private news organization, I'm getting paid for writing content, and there's an expectation that there'll be editorial control over that, right? They might publish my story or not. But here we're talking about people who are not the employees of Facebook, but who are consuming content that they provide in exchange for user data. I think another thing that we have to be very clear about is that Facebook is very transparent about what they do with our data. That's another reform that needs to be made, and you know, with Cambridge Analytica, and there's a lot of concern about that. So I'm not against reform, but I do see that the reforms are, I would say, around the margins, and I'm really concerned about the principle here. My ideal is that these services are just wide open. I think that's the best solution, and I think if people don't like what an Alex Jones says, then you have a system where you can set up a Facebook page. You know, you can find people to like your page and read your content, and you can provide withering critiques of Alex Jones.
Maybe have a social media of by and for the people, not of by and for big tech and the technocracy.
Well, I think it's a great way of putting it. It's a little frustrating that we haven't seen that. You know, I do grant that it's difficult to start up and build a company that has the reach of a Facebook. And I think that once it becomes established in our society, I think like so many other brands, people trust it and rely on it.
Lay down, G.I., lay down, G.I. We saw it all through the 20th century. And now in the 21st century, it's time to stand up and realize that we should not allow ourselves to be crammed into this rat race. We should not submit to dehumanization. I don't know about you, but I'm concerned with what's happening in this world. I'm concerned with the structure. I'm concerned with the systems of control, those that control my life and those that seek to control it even more. I want freedom. That's what I want, and that's what you should want. Control. They just feel the pain. Oh, so we'll willingly give up our sovereignty, our liberty, our destiny. We have got to realize that we're being conditioned on a mass scale. Start the challenge and support the slave state. The 21st century is going to be a new century. Not the century of slavery, not the century of lies, which is of no significance, and classism, and statism, and all the rest of those control. It's going to be the age of humankind standing up.
About the Trump presidency. From day one, issue one has been immigration. More specifically, the issue has been American anxiety about the rising tide of immigrants, especially Mexican or other non-white immigrants. Several days ago, I've been reading No One is Illegal by Justin Akers Chacon and Mike Davis, published by Haymarket Books. I've learned new things on virtually every page, especially the harrowing history of how the U.S. treated immigrants. happens over the years. The history of the U.S. is largely seen by the demand for workers from China, Japan, the Philippines, and later Mexicans. They would be invited, welcomed, super exploited by growers, and then they were demonized by politicians and media to be assaulted, insulted, and deported. These workers were paid a mere pittance. Some, like Chinese, were spit on in the street by white ruffians and vigilantes. Some were beaten. Some were killed. When Mexicans came north to take these jobs, some by way of the U.S. Bracero program, they were isolated and separated from others so that they could more easily be exploited. They were signed up to work by contract, and once that ended, they were deported back home to Mexico. They essentially feed the U.S. nation for pennies, only to be demonized, isolated, and forbidden to join unions. The hardest working get the lowest wages. Sound familiar? The struggles of migrant workers in the U.S. are truly eye-opening. It ain't pretty, but it gives us a lot to learn. That U.S. history ain't shown at the movies. Those stories have yet to be told. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Children, I can lay right down.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
I'm going to tell you a number of things, but you really only have to remember two words.
¿Será que no quiere pensar en lo que pudiera pasar si la mayoría en la nación empieza a gritar revolución? Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que piensa tu gente. ¿Quiénes son tu gente? Señor presidente, son los que quieren creerte y verte fuerte triunfar.
We're organizing against what we term genocide. Thousands of our young men are dying. We can stop that. Keep our families together. That's the first and most obvious form of genocide.
No. Su responsabilidad, prefieren no darle la razón a los que gritan revolución. Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que piensa tu gente. ¿Quiénes son tu gente? Señor presidente, son los que quieren creerte y verte fuerte triunfar. En nombre de la verdad. Piénsalo bien, que se está haciendo tarde. Muchos pensamos que tú eres un cobarde. El sentimiento Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que piensa tu gente. ¿Quiénes son tu gente? Oye, señor presidente, son los que quieren creerte y verte fuerte triunfar.
¡Uy!
¡Uy! El movimiento chicano.
Brown kids.
Think for yourself.
¿Será que no quiere pensar en lo que pudiera pasar si la mayoría en la nación empieza a gritar revolución? Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que piensa tu gente. ¿Quiénes son tu gente? Señor presidente, son los que quieren creerte y verte fuerte triunfar. En nombre de la verdad.
We turn now to the future of the Democratic Party. After a major debate, Democrats have voted on a key progressive demand after the 2016 campaign to vastly reduce the power of superdelegates in choosing the party's presidential nominee. The vote passed to a huge ovation and cheers on Saturday.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes overwhelmingly have it. And the report and the chart, the call, is adopted.
Saturday's vote of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee in Chicago, officially barred the superdelegates from voting on the first ballot to choose the party's presidential nominee unless a candidate has secured a majority of the convention using only pledged delegates whose votes are earned during the primary process. The vote to limit the influence of superdelegates comes after the 2016 race for Democratic nominee between Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It pitted many DNC members who supported the change against two former party chairs and members of the Congressional Black Caucus. For more, we're joined by someone who was there for what DNC Chair Tom Perez is calling a historic vote. Norman Solomon, National Coordinator of Roots Action, a Bernie Sanders delegate from California to the 2016 Democratic National Convention, where he coordinated the Independent Bernie Delegates Network, also Executive Director of Institute for Policy for Public Accuracy.
It was historic and very exciting, not only to be in the room when that vote was taken, but in the days ahead of that vote, out with people from my colleagues at RootsAction.org, Progressive Democrats of America, and elsewhere, picketing with that message that really is the gist. Democratic Party, live up to your name. And this was, I think, a tremendous victory that came not from the top out of the goodness of any hearts of those at the pinnacle of power of the Democratic Party, but from the base, the grassroots, people who have been angry, who have been organizing, especially in the last 2 years, to say that superdelegate power and leverage over the nomination process has to go.
I want to go to former DNC chair Don Fowler describing his opposition to restricting the power of superdelegates, speaking during an interview with the Chicago Sun-Times.
We're going to prohibit 200 African Americans, 100 Latinos, dozens of LGBTQ people and others from voting. Taking the vote away from these people.
This is former interim Democratic National Committee Chair Donna Brazile describing her opposition to curbing the power of superdelegates in an interview with the Chicago Sun-Times.
The question is whether or not automatic or so-called superdelegates, and there's nothing super about us, will be able to vote on the first ballot. The position of many in the party is that we deserve, those of us who are unpledged delegates, we deserve to have a voice in the process. And whether it's at the table with a vote or behind the scenes, raising money for candidates or taking candidates around, we believe that automatic delegates should continue to play a role because we're part of the sauce. We're part of the sauce for victory.
That was former interim DNC Chair Donna Brazile speaking after the vote she opposed. Norman Solomon, talk about this victory and how you organized for it and the fact that Tom Perez, the chairman of the DNC, voted with you.
Yes, frankly, Tom Perez, the chair of the DNC, was drag kicking and screaming, but ultimately very effectively to advocate for this, I think, very profound change. It should be said that the organization Our Revolution did a tremendous job in the last 2 years working inside and outside the Democratic Party to help organize this tremendous change. And a year ago, 6 months ago, it seemed virtually impossible to get such a clean sweep in terms of superdelegate power. What we heard from Donna Brazile there and Don Fowler was the anger of the old guard, losing their grip on power, losing their ability to put their thumbs on the scale. It is a new day. We're getting socialists elected to Congress through the Democratic Party primaries. We've got to keep organizing and fighting. Let's be clear, this is a victory for the grassroots, for progressives, but it's only a beginning. We have a long, steep mountain to climb, and we got to keep pushing.
But for people, especially outside this country, but I think inside this country as well, who just don't get what superdelegates are, explain exactly what happened. What power did you strip them? What power did they have?
Yeah, the gist is that superdelegates were 15% of the total Democratic National Convention to choose the presidential nominee. And those superdelegates were not elected elected for the purpose of or in designation from voters as to who the nominee should be. They were kingmakers. They had power apart from any Democratic lowercase d accountability, and they loved it. Every Democrat in Congress, every Democratic governor, Democratic Party officials, and they liked having candidates go to them hat in hand. Will you endorse me? Will you support me? Will you pledge your vote? And those advanced pledges were a huge boost to Hillary Clinton, not just 15% of the votes, but from the starting line, she was way ahead.
I mean, something that just infuriated not only Bernie Sanders supporters, but others, even I think Hillary Clinton supporters. At the very beginning, before the primaries, they were talking about they have wrapped up the superdelegate support, so they have won. So people who are going to go out to vote at all these primaries are saying, then why are we going out to vote?
Before a single ballot was cast in a Democratic primary or caucus, Hillary Clinton had more than half of the superdelegate votes, and that allowed the cable channels to run on their lower part of the screen. Hillary Clinton way ahead as the front runner. And an analogy would be, let's say you have two contestants in a race. The gun goes off, but at that moment, one of the racers is way ahead, and that is because of superdelegates. And not only that, by being way ahead at the start, then the nutrients, the vitamins, the water in the form of funding and media momentum is already given to that person, whereas in this case, Bernie Sanders was still the starting line. Now we have Trump, who has to be defeated, and progressives have this dual necessity to fight the right, the xenophobes, the racists. And let's be clear, in November, we can only defeat them through Democratic Party candidates to take back the House and hopefully even the Senate, but also to fight like hell for progressive principles, because let's face it as well, the Democratic Party is controlled by people who are part of the military-industrial intelligence complex, and they won't give it up without a big fight ahead.
Set your radio free. your radio free, ever up your TV, set your radio free.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Self-appointed insiders at this station were caught secretly working to break up the Pacifica network. In 1999, we successfully fought to preserve our precious network and produce many new shows. But today, I'm sorry to report, those same double-dealing, backstabbing corporate Democrats who stole the California presidential primary from Bernie Sanders are once again trying to break up this radio network for the benefit of party insiders and were recently caught acting in secret to incorporate a new nonprofit radio station using our exact call letters and mission statement. These same Democratic Party insiders have infiltrated the governance board of this station. Their aim is to capture our FCC broadcast license by forcing bankruptcy on the network, specifically refusing to submit a yearly financial audit. Once again, they are discussing the sale of WBAI for millions of dollars.
And this is TwitWit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time. Later in the show, Madame Blavatsky and the Pope share a blunt. Are we ready?
I'm ready, dear.
10-4.
Without objection.
Affirmative.
Would you like me to book you a flight?
First, are there any announcements?
Hello, am I on?
That's not an announcement.
Does the caller have an announcement?
Am I on the air? Hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Don't you recognize my voice?
Are you a disgruntled listener?
You put me on hold 15 years ago.
Well, it wasn't me. I'm 16 years old.
Well, I got my ballot in the mail last week. But who can figure this out?
What's the problem?
Well, how do I vote for the lesser evil in a race for 9 open seats with 24 candidates?
There's so much evil to choose from.
What's the problem?
I can't distinguish the progressive candidates from the fake progressive candidates.
Why not study the candidate statements?
But the candidates won't talk about it.
It's too complicated.
It's not too complicated.
Well, I'm tired of all the infighting.
How do you have an election without infighting?
Is the Pacifica Network going on the auction block or isn't it?
Why do you care?
I might want to buy a couple of the stations.
The membership won't allow it. Remember what happened in 1999?
For 600 points, give a misleading answer to this question. What happened in 1999?
I should know this. Oh, God. 1999.
Repeat the question, please.
For 666 points, give a misleading answer to this question. What happened in 1999?
President Kennedy was assassinated by a gang of lone gunmen.
Wrong.
The Grand Theft Auto 2 was released on PlayStation.
Wronger.
The breakup of Pacifica Radio was blocked by a listener uprising.
Yeah.
We have a winner. Congratulations.
I've waited 15 years for this.
15 years? Why aren't you tired of the infighting?
I'm not tired of the infighting. I'm tired of losing the infighting.
Well, that's why we have elections.
What's your beef?
I'm a vegetarian.
Okay, what's your beef?
On election day, on the morning news, it was announced that Hillary had already won the California primary before the voters cast their ballots.
Now, why would they do that?
That did suppress the vote for Bernie Sanders, of course.
But I heard that Bernie won the most ballots.
Yes, he did. But Hillary won the vote count.
Election fraud.
It's so obvious.
Is that your best argument?
No, I have a better argument. The other side stinks.
Electronic voting stinks.
Paper ballots are unreliable. Too much arithmetic. Electronic voting is a cost saving.
This guy is a corporate shell.
Back off. Corporate shills are people, too.
Do you think it is a coincidence that Pacifica is about to collapse when the left is split? Do you want another bad war?
No, I want a better bad war.
Point of misinformation.
Madame Blavatsky has a point.
Do you want another 9/11?
Are you the Madame Blavatsky from the astroplane?
I am interrupting this transmission for a special announcement. Your vote may not be counted. Not even once.
Why doesn't Madame Blavatsky run for a seat on the station board?
Well, I am in contact with the spirits of deceased subscribers who never tire of the infighting. It is very entertaining. Yes, I would like to represent the dead subscribers, but I cannot attend the monthly meetings. Saturday is all day astral bingo.
Do you have any advice for how to rid the station of fake progressives?
Ah, yes. Tell the listeners everything you know about what they are doing in secret. The secret KPFA Foundation and all this talk about selling WBAI. The listeners will drag their bodies through the streets and close the freeways like happened in 1999. But they must be told.
Well, I signed a pledge not to talk about it.
Why did you do that?
Well, I was brainwashed. I was flattered.
Keep talking.
I was invited to a retreat.
You know, the astral plane is crowded with ghosts of dead subscribers who listen online. Many dead listeners provided for this network in their will. The estate of my great-grandmother left all her preferred stock to Pacifica. You can't sell off the sister stations without violating listener equity of the dearly departed, darling.
Listener equity? How much are we talking about?
Oh, many millions since 1949. Since the beginning of the Cold War.
And another thing, listeners like me who call into the call-in shows, well, we should be paid a living wage.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Is that a motion?
I second this motion.
The motion has been seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
The motion passes. Listeners who call in and get on the air will be paid a living wage of $175 an hour.
You just bought my vote, dude.
Madame Blavatsky is against the law to buy votes. It's a totally corrupt campaign strategy.
So sue me. I have a dream. A community radio station full of programs made by local volunteer wobbly broadcasters like me, like the Woman's Magazine, and the Project Censored, and the Flashpoints. Dennis Bernstein is so hot. And the Block Report and Sideshow Radio, Apex Express, so many more. But without that stinking no-strike clause in the employee contract, what do we want?
Now!
When do we want it? Here!
Hey. Swing voter has a hand up.
Well, it's not my whole hand.
Go ahead.
I'm sick and tired of fake elections. I've tried to follow the money, but I never get any of it. What do I have to do to get ahead in this world?
Run for elective office. I got Chevron to give me $25 million to run for mayor of Richmond, didn't I?
Are you Nat Bates?
Well, I have changed my name from Nat Bates to Nate Bates to run for an open seat on the KPFA local adversary station board.
But why?
Well, to make Pacifica great again before selling off the assets and pocketing it 15% commission, the FCC broadcast licenses for WBAI, and the Los Angeles station are worth hundreds of millions. So, vote for me, and after I'm elected, listeners will be paid a living wage just for calling the station and talking with the show hosts about things they know nothing about.
How much are we talking about?
Well, $175 an hour living wage just for listening. You are not going to get a better offer from some socialist anarchist United for a Green Community Radio that only exists in your dreams.
And what is your end game?
To own the last remaining media network and force it to accept money from the corporate Democrat Party for the next 100 years. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I have a dream. I have a dream. Thank you. Thank you. I have a dream.
This is TwitWit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time. Later in the show, Cindy Sheehan on WBAI with Randy Credico.
I don't know what you people are talking about. We could not have had that discussion about the KPFA Foundation in public. It could not have been held in public at the time. It would have become the only thing that people were talking about. It would have totally derailed everything else that we were trying to do.
But I don't think the way to strengthen Pacifica is by threatening to take KPFA out of it. And I think the public is going to hear that. And there's been this denial for years that there wasn't a faction of us who wanted to see Berkeley or KPFA separate out from Pacifica. And I believe this starting of this fund, of this fake organization or whatever it is, I don't know, is another indication that this has been in the back of some people's mind for a long, long time.
So I don't understand everything that goes into what's happening here, the legalities of it all. But I think it would be a good idea to set up something to save the network, to keep the network. I didn't hear the Pacifica, the Pacifica network being mentioned. I think the network is the part of the key, not just the individual station.
For 200 points, give a misleading answer to this question. If the Cold War was a hoax, why wasn't it reported? Siri, the Cold War. Was it real or fake?
According to National Public Radio, the Cold War is real. According to George Orwell, the Cold War is a hoax.
Do you think so?
Hello? Hello, am I on the air?
Didn't you call in just a moment ago?
Yes. No. That was Nate Bates. I'm Nat.
I haven't even announced the phone number.
The truth is, I need the work.
You can be a guest on the show if you're a candidate.
It's a conflict of interest.
Well, yeah, I have important information in my head that the listeners need to know about.
Are you hearing voices?
I know how to read my own mind.
He's a crackpot.
Are you a crackpot?
Well, no. I'm a kook.
Oh, yeah, I got some for you.
But there's a difference.
Okay. Do you think the moon landings were faked?
No. The moon landings were real.
How can you be so sure?
Well, the astronauts drove four-wheel drive dune buggies on the moon, and I saw it on YouTube with my own eyes.
Yeah, that was cool.
But what if the video you saw was faked?
That's impossible because Photoshop didn't exist in 1969.
Is that your evidence? Neil Armstrong walked on the moon because Photoshop hadn't been invented yet?
I didn't say he walked on the moon. I said he had wheels. Now, Neil Armstrong drove a dune buggy on the moon, and I saw the video. The astronauts were popping wheelies, and that couldn't be faked in 1969.
Why are we talking about this?
For 1,000 points, give a half-true answer to this question. how did the astronauts get a four-wheel drive moon buggy on the moon?
Inflatable aluminum.
Wrong.
A hypnotic suggestion.
Wronger.
Stanley Kubrick.
We have a tie. Nobody wins.
Yay. 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 Popularly known as the Moon Buggy, 463-pound battery-powered off-road vehicles were transported to the moon in 1971 and 1972 to collect moon rocks for Michiko Kaku.
Well, let's take the next listener phone call. Hello, this is Science Fantastic. You're on the air. Any comments or questions?
I'm one of those people, actually, I might be one of those kooks that doesn't think we went to the moon. I don't think I'm a kook. I think I've got good reason to think we didn't go to the moon.
Some people think that we never brought moon rock back from the moon. Well, I had a chance to actually look at moon rock close up with a microscope, and I was shocked.
When President Ronald Reagan met Mikhail Gorbachev, he said that if we were ever attacked by the Martians, you and me, the Soviets and the capitalist U.S., would be allies in the fight against the Martians. Well, that's how Ronald Reagan looked at it, and believe it or not, there's some truth to it. If we are faced with a common enemy in outer space, it would indeed help to unite the Earth, just the way Ronald Reagan said.
In our obsession with antagonisms of the moment, we often forget how much unites all the members of humanity. Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize this common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us? What could be more alien to the universal aspirations of our peoples than war and the threat of war? What if all of us in the world discovered that we were threatened by an outer power from outer space, from another planet? Wouldn't we all of a sudden find that we didn't have any differences between us at all? We were all human beings, citizens of the world, and wouldn't we come together to fight that particular threat?
Reagan and Michiko Kaku. I'm Berkeley Kidd, and this is TwitWit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Yeah, the moon buggy was 10 feet long. It had two seats and Velcro-fastened safety belts.
You're making that up.
And how many moon buggies were left on the moon?
Three lunar roving vehicles were left on the moon. I don't believe it. I want to see for myself. Show me the pictures.
There are pictures?
Yeah, Hubble Space Telescope could easily photograph the lunar landing sites right now, but NASA won't do it.
I'm sick and tired of being humiliated and lied to by Makicho Kaku and Ronald Reagan, who want to scare me all the time.
Don't you get it?
An alien space invasion is needed to unite all nations under a central world bank to bring peace.
The banks don't want peace. They want global control.
When I'm elected to the local station board, I will pass a resolution to have the Hubble Space Telescope take some pictures of the moon.
Don't you think the Hubble Space Telescope has better things to do?
Yeah, I wouldn't believe anything photographed by that piece of space junk.
I don't know who to believe.
Well, roll the clip.
Did people go to the moon in 1969? I'm not totally sure. I wasn't on the moon then. Did they fake going to the moon? No, I'm pretty sure they didn't, because they couldn't. Some people say that in 1969, people were incapable of sending a man to the moon, but that they were capable of staging the whole thing in a TV studio. In fact, the opposite is true. but they did not have the technology to fake it on video. Now, please understand, I'm not saying this to defend the honor of the United States. The U.S. government lies all the time about all kinds of things. So it's easy to believe the Apollo program was a lie, too, especially if you weren't alive then, and if you don't know much about the technology profiles of the day. You see, the later you were born, the more all-powerful movie magic seems. Nowadays, it would be very easy to fake a moon landing, and we seem to have forgotten how to do it for real. Back then, it was the other way around, really. Meanwhile, film technology had gotten wider, and television was still busy trying to be in color. Now, here's where the stories diverge. In one version, the Americans waste $20 billion to send three guys to the moon, plant the plaque that says we came in peace for all mankind, and then go home to bomb Cambodia. In the more tantalizing version, NASA at some point realizes they just can't. So to avoid humiliation, they hire Stanley Kubrick to produce and direct the moon landing telecasts. You know, he did such a great job with 2001. Years later, once the Apollo astronauts are starting to collect Medicare, some people get a lot of attention by pointing out flaws in the photographic evidence from Apollo. The thing is, all these discussions are ignoring one simple point. In 1969, it was not yet possible, technically, to fake what we saw on TV. Why are people missing this? I think maybe they forget how primitive video was in 1969. I mean, it was an amazing achievement in electronics, but there was a lot they couldn't do. The pivotal claim for the Apollo hoax theory, without which it all falls apart, is that what we saw on TV was slow-motion footage of astronauts running around in a film studio. What's dangerous about that is that it blinds you to the real conspiracies that authorities are perpetrating on you right now, as we speak. Things that are a lot more important than whether some guys went to the moon. I'm not America, but if I were, I would much rather have you be questioning Apollo 11 and not questioning the Patriot Act, the Iraq War, the financial industry bailouts, and the right to indefinite military detention without charge. Those things are real. Go to the moon in 1969? I'm not totally sure.
We're talking with Nat Bates about space aliens, intergalactic war, and world peace.
It can happen at any time.
Nat Bates, are you running for an open seat on the local listener board?
And when I'm elected, we're going to have a safe KPFA.
Let's open it up to questions.
What qualifies Nat Bates to run this radio station into the ground?
Things are going to change around here.
What change?
First off, I want the employees to agree to a no-strike clause in the contract.
Been there, done that, next.
Second, and number two, we're going to reinstate special interest programming to alarm the public about what a Donald Trump administration will do. Bad things will happen. Hillary will crush Trumpzilla and build a trans-terrific partnership and casino hotel right there on the Richmond waterfront.
What else?
After I'm elected, I will get a bankruptcy judge to order me to sell the sister stations to pay our bills. WBAI alone is worth $100 million.
I have a question for Nat Bates.
I can't stay long.
Like, okay, do you believe that the Apollo moon landing was a hoax?
Well, the Apollo theater is real, and Reverend Sharpton is a hoax.
Do you think so?
CIA, top to bottom.
How can you be so sure?
We live in a hall of broken mirrors, kid.
Sorry, is your vision distorted?
I once believed I could win the Richmond mayor's race with a $25 million campaign budget from the Chevron folks.
The owners of Chevron are not folks.
No way.
I lost the mayor's race, so I'm running for an open seat on the KPFA listener station board.
I didn't see your name on the ballot.
As a write-in candidate, endorsed by Safe KPFA.
Are you making this up?
I have a recording of a recent board meeting.
For those who just turned in, we are talking with Nat Bates about his campaign to win a seat on the local station board.
A write-in candidate rarely wins.
Well, I don't expect to win.
Then why are you running?
To make Pacifica great again. I will build a wall between KPFA and the other five stations. I will sell WBAI to relieve the debt and pay my commission. We can get $100 million for WBAI, and I'm throwing in the Pacifica archive for a piece of future royalties. And we have to do this, or we risk becoming a healthy radio network run by volunteer clowns like you. Like you and you.
Me.
We are talking with Ivanka and Kellyanne Conway about opposition politics and community radio.
I am here against my will. We have been drugged with sodium fluoride.
Read this.
Under protest.
Hi, I'm Kellyanne Conway.
And I'm Ivanka Incorporated.
Listeners who are serious about resisting the coming police state can push back by donating $25 to a Pacifica radio station or an affiliate in your area.
If listeners fail to make the match, Kellyanne Conway and I will be forced to drink tap water bottled in Detroit.
I oppose tap water that's been bottled in Detroit.
And I don't pretend to swallow.
Oh, come on. Who's going to believe that?
Please, I'm sharing my worst nightmare.
Which is what?
Ivanka and I were thrown into the trunk of a car and driven to an undisclosed location on the top floor of the Empire State Building, where WBAI has a powerful broadcast antenna used to smear my president.
Not my president.
Is that unfair? Hate speech directed against my father is broadcast on Pacifica Radio all across the network.
Read the disclaimer, Ivanka. It says half true, more or less 100% of the time.
That's satire. Satire is being phased out.
It's unsustainable.
KPFT in Houston and WPFW in Washington, D.C. are going down.
Bankruptcy is perfectly legal.
That's my sister stations you're talking about.
The membership is not going to like this.
We will crush the membership.
This network is not for sale, lady.
Tell it to the bankruptcy judge. It happens all the time. I'm writing a book about it, how Making America Great Again crushed community radio.
You can't crush an idea.
Oh, yes, I can.
I'm writing a book, too. The President is a Fink by Melania Trump.
That is fake fiction.
If you publish that trash, the FCC will break up this network and there's no telling who will purchase the broadcast license.
Breitbart needs a radio station in D.C. Do you know of any FCC licenses for sale in the D.C. area?
Pacifica Radio is worth more dead than alive.
Isn't it illegal to profit from a non-profit charity?
No, it's not. It's called cashing out.
It's perfectly legal if a bankruptcy judge and the FCC say it's legal.
But we have to act fast.
What are you worried about, Kellyanne?
I have intermittent Botox fatigue.
And that concludes this week's TwitWit Radio with the TwitWit Radio cast and crew live from KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley.
Would you allow this man to be taken back into it? Kapono, O Hawaii, if just for a day our king and queen would visit all these islands and saw everything, how would they feel about the changes of our land? Could you just imagine if they were around and saw highways on the sacred grounds? How would they feel about this modern city life? Tears would come from each other's eyes as they would start to realize that our people are in great, great danger now.
This is the Berkeley Signal.